Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Well,
what's up?
How you doing?
I'm good, man. Thank you for doing this again. I'm pumped.
No, me too. Let me just do the intro. You know, I'm here with Lance Oppenheim. The show is called Ren Faire. Second time that you've been on the show. Congratulations. I really, really am enjoying it.
Oh, hey, thank you. Thanks for having me back. You know, I think you're the one of the few people I was able to. I feel like we could talk about both things. You've seen it all.
I did my homework. You know, it's a low bar, but hopefully I'm clearing it.
Good. No, I feel like you. The depths of my brain have now been exposed. All of the dreams that I've had for the last like 3 years were, I usually would dream about the king, actually, King George. Mm-hmm. In my dreams, he would be a massive kind of giant. And his house would be so much bigger. But then there would be times too where there would be not necessarily like the sperm donors from Sperm World, but there would be some sort of scatological, sperm semen theme in the dream too. So anyway, it all is fucked up, man. I don't know.
That sounds horrifying. That's, what's it like when you're, I imagine like you've spent years on these projects. Like, what's it like just sort of sitting on those and, hoping for like the best outcome while no one in the world but you and your crew has seen it yet?
Well, I mean, I think with Sperm World, it was a little different because we had been testing it so often for people just to get a sense of what was working and what wasn't. And with Ren Faire, we were kind of flying a little blind. I mean, it's harder to get people to watch 3 episodes, you know? It's a taxing thing. It almost felt like asking a friend to read a script. It's like people, they will always say yes, but then they're just like, oh fuck, there's another one of these things. Shit. Okay. I'll have to watch it. I'll watch it tomorrow. And then it's like tomorrow rolls around. You watch it yet? Like, oh, okay. I'll watch it. Yeah. I'll watch it. 3 weeks go by. They still haven't seen it. So it's the long story short, I'd say it's overwhelming, but there was also a great team around Ren Faire. I worked a lot really with Ronnie Bronstein, who directed Frownland and edited Uncut Gems and Good Time and mm-hmm. Heaven Knows What, and writes with Josh, would edit with Benny. You know, he's a brilliant person, and he came into the process pretty late in the game and kind of provided. And when he did come in, it was such an all hands collaboration. He was so in there with my editors Max Allman and Nick Nazmi and I that it felt like I had 50 billion brains at once. I mean, this guy just is like, he's brilliant. He's right. A genius. So I kind of felt like I didn't need anyone else to watch it after he came in and sort of blessed the project with his ideas.
Right. I mean, yeah. So you got him and the Safdies involved. So you got sort of this, you got a pedigree to it. Like at what point in the process does that happen? Like, had they seen like some kind of Heaven or something and you pitched this, like where did you guys meet in the process?
Well, it's funny. I mean, really the collaboration with the Ilara and the Safdies, it came about because David Govey Herbert, my co-creator on this project, the journalist who came to me with the story, he actually had a relationship with an executive at Ilara Pictures named Danny Bernfeld. They had optioned one of his articles that was about it was called Daddy Ball, and it was an article I personally was trying to go after before this project even existed, and I lost it all to Alara Pictures. And so him being a good the great diplomat he is, he was the great connector as well, and so he brought us all together, and I think initially maybe there was some maybe reservations a little bit. I'm not sure Josh or Benny were even aware that the project existed once it was greenlit. Maybe they became aware of it when it was greenlit by HBO, but they probably weren't that aware of it when it was going, when it was first developing, because they were working on their own stuff. But I think most people involved in it, they liked Some Kind of Heaven, but they were sort of like, there's no story to that movie. And I was like, what are you talking about? There's plenty of story to that movie. But I understood what they meant, which is that probably reading between the lines, it's like, you know, most of the films I've made before this one are all, they're very internal, you know, and they're about emotions, and each scene is about a want, and then you see sort of an external obstacle or maybe an internal obstacle that emerges. And with this story, it was very different. I mean, to begin with, I had a story, you know, I was coming into a project where I wasn't discovering what the story was. And certainly there were elements that the story kept transforming in this one, but I was entering this with a hook. It wasn't with a character. It was, or a world that was there. But the hook was that there was this existential conflict that would emerge once this man, King George, would no longer be king. So what the fuck happens? What happens to the people that want the power that he has? And what happens to the people in the community around him that he governs? And so, yeah, it was different.
Right. So the king, George Kulam, he's like, I think the press release said like succession in the world of Texas Renaissance fairs or something to that effect. He's the Logan Roy of the whole Ren Fair world. So like one of the things, like when I was going into this movie about the Ren Fair culture, I guess I was like sort of picturing people being like very worried about like the historical accuracy of it, and like the the period touches, I don't know, coming at it from like the perspective of sort of a history nerd. It's funny, it feels like they are like the subculture is sort of divorced from the representation of the era in a certain way.
No, I mean it's sort of became a place where I think in the I mean they're about to have their 50th year, so I think in the early days of that specific fair, it was sort of a byproduct of like the deadhead culture, and there was a lot of artists and stoners and acid heads, and this really amazing magical time where a way of being started to exist, and for artists that maybe couldn't exist anywhere else, they were there. And so there was this really homegrown organic thing. I think the thing that George the King ended up doing over time is he introduced an idea and a way of making, really commercializing, capitalizing on the fair, and turning it into not just this kind of this place where drunken hippies would kind of be walking around, but a place where people would make tons of money. And I think that there's conflict there over that. And I think so what you see in the series, and also what you see when you go there now, is there it's a place of complete anachronism. You know, there's people that are wearing like Jason Voorhees masks that are walking around next to people that are dressed as like medieval stooges or something. And look, this isn't even a medieval, the Renaissance is not medieval. The Renaissance is its own period.
That's what I was trying to figure out. I'm like, oh, Renaissance, like, okay, what's that going to be like? And then it seems like the shows are like indistinguishable from like medieval times and stuff. And then,
yeah, it's a place of it's fully, there's still little pockets of magic in it. And I think, the community is still there, and the magic comes from the people that work it, and that, that have so much love for the culture of it, but it is a plastic place a little bit now, you know, and the irony of George Kulam hating, plastic breasts, kind of, I wonder if there's any correlation between him hating like plastic lances rather than having the real thing, that's there. But, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say I was late to this because I was actually at an Olive Garden and I was interviewing a prospective mate about, so that, you know, obviously like that's one of the most memorable sequences, or yeah, like the two most memorable scenes are George taking these women that I guess he's met on sugar daddy sites to the Olive Garden. And the scene is like you expect them to sort of try and get to know each other, but like the only two questions you see him ask these women is like whether whether their breasts are real. Like, what was did you interview those women? What was like, what was that whole situation?
I mean, yeah, that was really it was damn near impossible to figure out a way to film this film those date scenes, because I mean, we were dealing with a myriad of just logistical and ethical considerations. I mean, the first being, you know, George's dating coach or consultant, the King Scroller, Victor. He would always say, like, look, I'm happy to put you in touch with some of George's dates, but if it goes poorly and it's a result of your presence, I could be fired. And so I was like, Jesus Christ, I don't want that responsibility. And, you know, George would always invite us to go, but then it would always be like, Victor would look at us and he'd be like, please don't, you know, so it was difficult. And then also the other dimension where if Victor wasn't reaching out to these women ahead of time, then you're going to be filming someone who may not really want to be filmed at all. Right. And that would be ethically, I think, really dubious and not okay. And so what we ended up having to do is we engaged in, you know, a casting process really to find people that, that this is what they do professionally. And we explained to them sort of the score of who George is and what he's after and how we thought this would probably go down. And then we would give their application, so to speak, to Victor, George's dating consultant guy. And then he would give it. And so we casted it for them, but we made it very aware to George and everyone around him, and to the women that ended up showing up, how we thought this would likely go. And of course, when George showed up, he did and said what I don't think we were expecting him to do or say. I mean, I remember we had a whole shot figured out where he was going to sit on the opposite of the woman at the first Olive Garden date. And the moment he showed up, he sat in the same row as her. Mm. And I remember just being so upset because the shot I was trying to capture, there would be some backlit through the window. It would have been nice.
Yeah.
Was ruined. And then I was just looking at the other camera that we had there. And I just was like, what in the fuck is going on? Why is he sitting in the same, he doesn't even know this person. He's sitting in the same row, the same booth as her. But yeah, that was those scenes came very much late in the game because we had come so close before to just tagging along or talking to someone that he was that, you know, his dating consultant had found for him. But then for various reasons, it just never happened. And so I knew we were running out of time and out of money. And I knew that the only way to probably do this was to find someone that would be open to being filmed and then making sure George was okay to go on a date with them and see kind of from there how it would go.
So when you say they do this professionally, like they are professional, like sugar daddy havers, what is that?
I mean, it depends. I think like they in the past have had some dimension of experience that relates to what, you know, to talking to an elderly man who's paying you for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the other dimension of this too is because the film is, and this is what I was describing to everyone who signed up, and we, you know, the two women that were at the Olive Garden, you know, we were going to photograph this in a way that would just, it would transcend what we would, a normal documentary would do. So it wasn't just us observing. There was a whole dimension. You see this in the second episode where she's stirring the water and then there's a close up of her. And, you know, we would try and elevate this to feel like something that isn't just reporting that is just complete nonfiction. So
yeah.
I think that was also something that was interesting to them, as because in a way I think any person who engages in sugar daddy, sugar baby, whatever you want to, you know, the profession of going out with someone and kind of a girlfriend experience or something. They're performers, no different than how Jeff Baldwin is a performer at the Renaissance Festival. There's
Right.
an
Yeah.
engagement with the camera that I think was interesting to them and to me too.
Right. So, yeah, I think in the last time we talked, you described your process as sort of like trying to set up these sort of artificial or, staged situations in order to get to the truth of what like the subject is like through, them trying to present themselves in that staged way. Was that sort of part of were the date scenes sort of part of that process?
Well, I mean, not necessarily in the sense that they were. I mean, look, George, every twice a week, he'll go to the Olive Garden, and you know, if you go there on a Tuesday, he'll be there at like probably 12 o'clock. It's clockwork. He goes to the Olive Garden. He goes to Macaroni Grill. He goes to Luby's, and he goes to this other place called Demasi's. And but Olive Garden is usually the main place he'll go on a date. And it's this one specific booth in the back of the restaurant. That's where we filmed. I think working with George was different than how I've filmed with other people in the past. You know, in terms of staging things, it's never really about like it has to derive from something real. Like it has to be a real routine, it has to be a real desire. And you know, whether it's like me in the villages, you know, I remember Barbara wanted to buy a golf cart, but she what probably wasn't planning on doing so anytime soon, but she was still interested in going to the golf cart shop and looking at some stuff. And so we were filming that, and then that whole other thing happened in some kind of heaven where she develops this relationship with the golf cart salesman. And I think in this, I guess it was different in a sense in that like this was photographing a real routine that George does, which is going on a date at the Olive Garden, hoping it goes well. I think you know, working with Jeff was very different because anytime Jeff was on camera, he was extremely conscious of the camera, but in ways that I think are very different than the average person. He would kind of take the theatricality of his life and his situation, the way he would relate to his life and situation, and he would kind of play up his emotions to the camera in this really operatic way that I think is no less truthful than the way George acts on camera. It's his own relationship with reality and sort of the aspirational dimension of how he wanted to be captured.
I mean, I have so many questions.
Hey everyone, Matt Lieb here. If you know me, you know there's only two things in this entire world I care about more than rewatching my favorite TV shows. It's gut health and former karate champion Chuck Norris. That's why I love Morning Kick. You're probably asking, what is Morning Kick? Well, I'll tell you. It's a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Look, I live in Los Angeles, all right? And this is a city defined by its culture of people drinking green drinks. Unlike the other green drinks out there, this one actually tastes good. It tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade. It's so good. And since I started drinking Morning Kick, my digestion is smoother and my body looks leaner. And I have energy all day energy, which I need because I have a child and she's walking now, which means she's running now, which means I need energy. The thing I like most about Morning Kick is how easy it is to make. Just mix with water and stir. Simple. No blenders, no convection ovens, no turning your pantry into a science lab in order to make a SCOBY so you can brew your own probiotic drink. No. All you need to do is have some water and get yourself some Morning Kick, stir it in a glass, and baby, that digestion of yours, smooth. Smooth like silk. And you're gonna look good. And you're gonna feel good. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/podyourself for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/podyourself today. All right, let's get back to the show. Summertime and the living is thirsty. At least it is in the Lieb household. And when we are trying to get hydrated, we reach for the best water on Earth. Fiji water.
Fiji water is bottled at the source and untouched by man until you unscrew the cap. Fiji water really is from the islands of Fiji, 1,600 miles from the nearest continent, and it is sourced from an ancient artesian aquifer and is naturally preserved from external elements.
That's right, Vince. You can literally taste the difference. So whenever we do an ad, we sometimes get samples sent to us of whatever we're advertising. And when I first got sent Fiji water bottles in the mail, I thought it was hilarious. I was like, I've tasted water before. Why would they do this? But believe me when I say this is absolutely the best water I've ever tasted. And that's because Fiji water is a natural artesian water with 100% natural electrolytes. Unlike some other top premium bottled water brands, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring.
That's right, Matt. Fiji water has more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium bottled water brands, giving it its signature smooth, soft taste. Fiji water is the number one premium imported bottled water brand in the US, and it has a perfectly balanced 7.7 pH.
Also, Fiji water's 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles are made from using 100% recycled plastic. Fiji water continues to lead the top premium bottled water competition on launching 100% recycled plastic bottles. The aquifer Fiji water originates from is a sustainable source and will continue to replenish as the rain and water cycle persists in the islands of Fiji.
So get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water.
It's Fiji water.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
But okay, so like just to go all the way back to the beginning. So George, he wears like this sort of what is the uniform? What is the shirt that he's always wearing, like with the medals and the stars on it?
It's a custom designed shirt. George did serve in the military, I think in his 20s. He was in Germany, but he was not awarded anything for his service. I think that shirt comes from I think he was inspired by British royalty. He's what he had told me before. And I think about 15 years ago, he just started, it may be even sooner than that, but all he wears is just that shirt in red or in black, red in the summertime, black every time else. And, you know, it has like an interesting fabric to it. It's like one of those Under Armour type shirts or like those shirts that you'd go to the
Texas. Yeah,
exactly. So it's like an athletic shirt as well as a shirt that you can kind of dress up or dress down.
I love it. I mean, he's the modern day Colonel Sanders or Tom Parker with the self-styled like military thing that doesn't really, again, it feels like a representation that's somehow divorced from the thing that it's representing. Like he's,
yeah.
My friend is a graphic designer was talking about people that are really into like the tiki aesthetic. And I was sort of asking if, that has anything to do with them liking like Polynesia or the culture. And he's like, no, it's just like completely separate from that. And I was kind of getting that vibe from these people at the Renaissance Fair. Like, you know, you got Louis, the kettle corn guy, and he, like you said, it's just a place for anachronisms, and he seems like he's dressed like a steampunk, or he's got like a leather hat and like a vest. Is that his does he have a, is there a backstory like for that costume or anything
steampunk
like that?
Victorian fantasy. I think it's just people. I mean, I think Jeff says it at the end, and then ultimately this becomes, I think, the sort of tragedy of the series. It is it's not just about playing pretend professionally, I think, because or just playing pretend on the stage that is the Renaissance Fair. I think all the back office stuff, there's another fantasy dimension, right? Which is the aspirations of being king.
Mm.
When Jeff says at the end, when you come to the Renaissance Festival, you or anyone else could play, could be something that you're not. You could play the fantasy. It's this sort of tacit acknowledgement that he knows he'll never be king. And they all sort of know they'll never be king, but they're comfortable encircling it maybe for the rest of their lives. They're okay acknowledging that it's folly, that it's a merry-go-round. It's something that it's the carrot that's dangled in front of them, but maybe the only way they know how to exist is in pursuit of that thing. And even this morning, the craziest thing happened, which is George, I talked to him. He just watched the second and third episode. Everyone else had seen it before him. He saw the first one. He loved the series, which is crazy. And he loved it so much that he asked, his only thing that he had asked me was, what is the song that Jeffrey sings in his car? And I told him it was from Shrek the Musical. He called Jeff into his office this morning and said, what's the name of the song that you sing in your car? And Jeffrey said, it's a song called Who I'd Be. And George said, good, Jeffrey, good. And he said, he apologized to Jeffrey for how he treated him. And then he fired everyone at the festival this morning, and he gave Jeff his old job back.
Oh,
the bonus.
So this is a scoop.
This is a scoop. Yeah, So Jeff is now the general manager of the fair, and it's as a result of. Jeff said it was the documentary when George watched it. It was like the three ghosts from Christmas past visited him and awoken something within him.
Oh wow! So, well, that's a happy ending of sorts. Yeah.
It's a bittersweet ending because I think, you know, George is now sending Jeff to India on a chocolate convention. I don't know what the fuck is going on there with that, but Jeff is so excited to go, and I'm like, Jeff, literally this is what happened before. This is you say it in the series. It's happening now. You know what's going to happen when you go to India, Jeff? George is going to have a meeting with Louis, like he has in this series.
Court politics are all about proximity to the leader. You can't leave him.
So it's like George gave him the job and is sending him off and wants Jeff to go. And of course, Jeff, it's how are you going to turn down like an all expenses paid for vacation really to India? But it's interesting. I've just been like the events that happen in the series are going to happen again. And they will continue to happen until the day George dies, most likely. And the fact that that is the reality that everyone lives in there, ultimately, I think, gives the show. I know a lot of people who are watching it are like, is this real? Is this fake? What's going on? How you made this? You know, the tragedy is that it is all real. And the performance and even the aspirational qualities of how Jeff acts on camera, I think it reveals a much more tragic and interesting kind of psychological outlook on this whole situation, which is that it's like a performance of pain.
Right. He's a pain piggy.
Owning the pain by luxuriating in it.
Yeah.
You know, for a camera.
There was a couple, like you mentioned Shrek the Musical, and I feel like that was one of a couple like memorable laugh out loud moments that were like unexpectedly laugh out loud moments like that. And just I think it was at the beginning of episode 2 where his driver, he says, yeah, or no, it's one of the grounds guys, like, yeah, George is really into Enya. And I don't know why that just struck me so funny, them like all doing yard work listening to Enya like 24/7. But there's a few things I wanted to ask. Louis, the kettle corn steampunk guy, like how many energy drinks is he going through like in the course of a day?
Well, it's interesting. Vanity Fair just interviewed Louis. I don't know if you saw this, asked him that question, and he gave an answer. The most personal detail Louis Migliaccio offers is that he typically consumes between 8 and 14 energy drinks a day, compared to just 2 or 3 in the off season.
Holy shit. 8 and 14, those things have like, I mean, that's got to be like 6 times the like maximum allowable level of caffeine in your body.
No, I mean, it's the funny thing is, I feel like because so many other parts of the series are so dressed up, and there's this dimension by which, I'm trying to take all of the like Renaissance magic and the milieu and the Wilhelm screams and just sort
Oh
of
yeah.
this
Yeah, where were those
absurdism.
coming from? Did you add those in, or were those just like where did those come from? The
No,
Wilhelm
I add those
screams.
in. I, you know, it's to
Yeah.
me, it's sort of like a love letter to the culture in a way. It's or just the magic of the place and the absurdism and the silliness and getting lost and the escape of all of that. But then there are moments like Louis and his energy drinks, which are naturally unto itself equally, I'd say, as absurd as the anyone dressing up or the milieu or a talking dragon. It's to me but I think the tragedy of the show and the thing that's interesting about it is it's ultimately the drama that is happening is real. It's just happening in a very unreal place. And so I constantly wanted to heighten that sense of being there, like the immersive dimension, the
Yeah.
senses, the sounds, the visuals, the editing pattern, even the like if I had the access to smell-o-vision, I would have thrown that in there too. And I'm
Yeah.
trying to take all this shit, just cram it into the screen so that you can hopefully that the denseness of it you can lose yourself in.
Yeah. The arc as in watching the series, like, from start to finish in chronological order, like the way the show is structured, it sort of feels like George gets nastier as it goes along. Was that something that you felt like was occurring while you were shooting, or was that sort of something that you, an arc that you created through the edit?
No, I mean, I think I always knew that the third episode, whatever would happen, would have to feel different than the other two. Once Jeff was fired, I knew that there was the fun and fantasy and the magic of the place should go away. And so, we shifted the way we were shooting, like we changed our lenses. There's a lot less use of Steadicam. It's mostly locked off shots. But in terms of George's behavior, I think the closer after he fired Jeff, the closer he got to selling the festival with the Greeks and then with Louis, and even just these dates he'd go on, like the last one, which did not go particularly well. He took it out on everyone around him. There was a feeling of I don't know, extreme annoyance, but also, he would just tell me things. He'd call me late at night and talk about how his two brains were arguing with each other. And one side would say, it's $60 million, George, take the money. And the other side of his brain would say, these people would cause, I think, forget the word he used, but basically he said like, they would not let you be happy for the rest of your life. And so I think he just was battling this feeling. It's the feeling of everything really in the show. The first episode, he's barely focusing on the festival and he's really thinking more about his companion and his art stuff. And the second episode, he's starting to think a little bit about the festival, what it means to him, because there's a deal on the table and he thinks it's not enough money. And then the third episode, he finally gets in the game and he focuses on the festival and you see what he's like when he when his attention is turned up, and that's George, it's the good, the bad, the ugly. One person I was speaking with recently compared him to like how they used to think an auteur, like filmmaker, would probably handle themselves on set, that they would suffer no fools. I think that George is like an extreme example of that, but he is an artist and he has a vision, and it's inscrutable. At times, what he actually wants. And when you do something for him, or he asks you to do something that you don't know how to do, when you ask him, how should I do it? He says, just do it. Louis, just write it down. Write it
Yeah,
down,
it's like
Louis. It's like,
he's
what do you want me to write down? It's
he's
this
simultaneously mad that you don't know and mad that you would ask him what he's talking about. It's like it's yeah.
But I hope people take something away from it a little bit. I mean, look, it's George to me is no different than like any leader right now that is I mean, politically we have two very old presidential candidates. I feel like a lot of the great, you know, a lot of things in culture, you know, you look at Disney, you look at, I don't know, SNL, you look at a lot of things right now, and there's a lot of old, not to say that there's any issue with having an older leader, but I think when you start to probably think about what they're going through and why are they still doing this? Can't they just retire? Can't they just leave it to someone else? Isn't there someone they've been mentoring? Like Jeff says, you know, Willy Wonka didn't just leave the chocolate factory for Charlie. You know, it was a mentorship. It took decades. Mm-hmm. He taught Charlie how to run the chocolate factory. I think that the reason that anecdote is funny in a way is because Willy Wonka, if he was George Coulomb, would never leave the chocolate factory to fucking anyone ever. And yeah. I think that's it's exactly what you see. I think that's exactly what we're experiencing culturally at this exact moment. And I don't really have an answer for how we got here or why. But I think the way that this story ends up unfolding, it ends up becoming much bigger than just, you know, a bunch of people arguing about why they should be the person in charge at this Renaissance fair. It ends up becoming a portrait of like America in miniature or something. Mm-hmm. At least that is what it is to me.
Right. All right. Last question, because I know you're pressed on time. Say like Andy Cohen and the Bravo universe come to the Texas Renaissance Festival and they and they shoot their version of like, how does that production differ from like what you're doing in this documentary?
Well, I feel like what the Vanderpump Rules universe, and you know, when I made that when I said that thing about how this was like Vanderpump Rules and There Will Be Blood, those were the two things I was interested in. I mean, look, reality TV is very different than I think what I do. Like reality TV, there are story producers. There are people that write storylines and they and write things for people to say. And there's coaching of people to sort of hit the beats that the producers want their story to tell. Ultimately, like I'm engaging in a creative representation of reality, but I'm not scripting reality. I'm not telling people what to do. There is no script. That's the reason this shit takes 3 years plus to make, is because I'm there, you know, basically, I shot 110 days on this damn thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is like, there are days where I don't shoot really much of anything usable, but I'm just there and I need the chance for something to happen. And then for me to be there with the rest of my crew and then really kind of in real time, figure out the best way to cinematically express that idea, is important. So I'd say that's probably the biggest thing. But the thing I do love about reality TV, and I think the thing that I'm constantly curious about trying to push my stuff maybe to feel a little closer to, is that when people watch a reality TV show, they are not paying attention or asking the question of what is real and what is not. And I don't know why that is. I think maybe part of it is because these shows have well-oiled machines and they're probably written pretty well. You know, the way you engage with it is the way you'd engage with a great fiction film. And I feel like the dialogue around documentaries right now, especially with this series, people have trouble disengaging with the reality quotient. Like, I think even because there's a talking dragon, which to me announces itself as obviously artifice, but the expression that Jeff is feeling is real. And the fact that he's even collaborating with me on that moment expresses another form of reality. Like what I like about Abbas Kiarostami's movies is that exact idea. It's almost like you're taking dimensions of how maybe reality TV shows are made in contemporary time, but you're trying to find artful ways of bending those ideas into reality rather than taking reality and bending it into fiction. So I don't know. What I feel like I'm doing is not new, and like Kiarostami did, and I mean like Robert Greene does it, and you know Josh Oppenheimer did it with The Act of Killing. Mm-hmm. Very different versions of what I'm doing, but I feel like there's a rich dialogue that hopefully this type of show can at least unlock if a lot of people end up watching it, which I hope. I hope that they'll engage with the larger themes of the show, and then once they start to think about it a bit more, then I hope they think about, well, hey, wait a second, what that, why is that considered a documentary if there's all these things that feel fabricated, or if there's these fantasy dimensions? And then I hope they read stuff like that Vanity Fair article where the subjects were interviewed and talk about how all of this shit was real. And even though they would work with me on these sort of fantasy, fantastical expressions of their reality, what they feel like is on the screen represents their lives as true as it can come. And right. In that sense, then maybe this is the only way you can really make a documentary in a place that's as larger than life. If you don't, then you're not capturing the full scope of the canvas. So anyway.
Thanks a lot. Anything to add before I let you go?
No, man, thank you for everything. I mean, I love talking to you, man. I will always remember your support on Some Kind of Heaven. So I, you know, thank you for giving me the outlet to talk.
No, thank you. I'll take it. Yeah, loved it. Thanks a lot.
Cool. All right. Peace.
All right. Take care.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Create the deck of your dreams now at Menards. Spend less time maintaining your deck and more time enjoying it. With UltraDeck low-maintenance composite decking from Menards. It's easy to install and built to last. Plus, get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store and on Menards.com. Save big on UltraDeck. And check out more great deals happening now at Menards. Save big.